Award-winning novelist Richard Ford on telling his parents' story, living and writing in Maine, and love of the boss. Richard Ford's 1995 novel, Independence Day, was the first book to win both a Pulitzer Prize and Pen Faulkner Award. Throughout the years, his novels and short stories have won praise from reviewers and from a certain New Jersey-born rock and roll legend. Ford's new book is not fiction. It is a memoir, or two memoirs published together, one about his father, the other about his mother. Two remembrances written 30 years apart. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Richard Ford about his parents, his father, who died when Ford was 16, his relationship with his mother before and after his father's death, and his decision to write about them. We'll also ask him about his essays for The Guardian newspaper and living in Maine. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Author Richard Ford is originally from Mississippi, but now lives in East Booth Bay with his wife, Christina. He's probably best known for such novels as The Sports Writer and Independence Day, which features sports writer-turned-real estate agent Frank Bascom. Ford has won a Pulitzer Prize and the Penn William Faulkner Award. He has taught writing in Dublin, Ireland, the University of Mississippi, and Columbia University, to name a few. We are thrilled to have him in our studio to talk about his new memoir. It is called Between Them, and it's about the lives of his parents, Parker and Edna Ford. Richard Ford, thanks for being here today.
I'm glad to be here, Jennifer. Glad to meet you.
Do you have a favorite book or story by Richard Ford? Would you like to ask him that question directly? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Richard Ford, I'm going to have you do something that it's not really conventional, since you just came out with a memoir, but I stumbled upon this review you wrote last fall of Bruce Springsteen's memoir, and I just love the first sentence, so I was wondering if you would read it to us.
Well, I have to have enough breath to read it, of course. It seems to be about 1,000 words long. For most of us Nigerian Bruce Springsteen fans who stood through years of his barn-burning, bombs-dropping, ceiling-cracking, ozone-splitting, three-hour mega-extransit concerts in all manner of nasty weather and good, who've bought and rebought album after album, who've pored over lyrics, mused over his complex musical and band life as well as his privacy-shrouded marital, familial, and psychic forays, and who've surrendered, who've demarked sovereign occasions in our own lives with the strains of no surrender running through our hectic brains for all of us in his global audience. The perpetual fascination of Bruce, I've never, I give you my word, shouted that out at a concert, is simply, how the hell do you get from Freehold, New Jersey to this in only 50 short years?
I love that sentence. You teach writing.
No, I teach literature.
You teach literature.
Yes, I do. I'm too old to teach writing.
Okay.
And I don't have the investment in young kids becoming writers these days, not because I'm inured to their problems or because I'm uninterested in their futures, but because I think I'm better off teaching people to read than I am teaching people to write. Young people come to Columbia burning to write, and they spend a lot of time writing, but they don't spend, in my view, enough time reading. And when you want to learn how to write, that's what you should be doing, reading. So I'm teaching people to read.
What do you assign in your class?
Well, this time we did a course this last semester, which just ended 2 weeks ago, a course in memoir, because memoir was on my brain this year. These are memoirs about death, and which is not as morbid as it sounds. I wanted them to read memoirs about death because I wanted them to see how really good writers undertake really big subjects, death being one. So we read Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking. We read Christopher Hitchens' book about his own demise to come. We read Blake Morrison's book called When Was the Last Time You Saw Your Father? We read Julian Barnes' book about the death of his wife. We read Donald Hall's book about the death of his wife, and a couple of others.
The reason I wanted to read that sentence is I think that sentence you wrote about Bruce Springsteen After reading your memoir, I think you could write it about yourself. How the heck did you get to be who you are? In your memoir, we learn that your parents didn't read to you.
No.
You describe yourself as a middling high school student. You went off to college to study hotel management.
And barely got in, actually. Yeah, I describe myself as a middling high school student, complimenting myself, actually, when I do that. How does that happen? Well, you know, fortunately, I believe more in, I suppose, nature rather than nurture. I could say just practice, 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 work, 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 but I wouldn't be wrong if I said that. But the fact of the matter is how a child becomes who a child becomes as an adult is always slightly a mystery. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we like literature. Mavis Gallant said one time that if we knew what went on, for instance, between a man and a woman, we wouldn't need literature. So to try to plot out the force lines and causalities from a life in Mississippi and a life as a writer, which has lasted 50 years, it would be difficult to do and probably always inexact. But what I would say mostly was, if I had to choose one thing, was that my parents loved me. And my parents, by virtue of loving me, and I loved them, freed me to a certain extent from those sort of parental fears and over-guidances to be what I wanted to be. They just thought that I was different from them just as much as I realized they were different from me. And that's always a good thing for kids to understand about their parents and for parents to understand about kids.
You write, if I can only read my own writing here, being both a late child and an only child is a luxury.
Sure. It is a great luxury. At least I think it's a luxury. People could argue with that, I think with some cause and argue. But for me, my parents were married 15 years before I was born. They really wanted me when I came along. I came along quite by surprise in a sense. I think they had conceded that they weren't going to have children. I'm not even sure they knew what caused children. But they had me when they were 35 and almost 40. And so, as I say, they wanted me. It also was a life in which they were indisputably the adults in the room. I was indisputably the child in the room. Nobody was ever in doubt about that. When you know, it's wonderful when you can be very young and have children, I think. But it's sometimes not so lucky because very, very young parents have never fully gone through their own adolescence and childhood, whereas my parents had. And I could take an interest in them, which was an interest in the real world, as I saw it. I think it hasn't been a detriment in what I've done with my vocational life.
This memoir is really two memoirs, which you wrote 30 years apart. And it's interesting to me, your mother's memoir, you play second, but you wrote that one first.
Right.
Did you write that 30 years ago, not intending to publish it?
No, I published it in Harper's Magazine 30 years ago when I wrote it. I didn't publish it as a book, only when Vintage Books published a little volume called Vintage Ford did it get a book publication in the United States.
Okay.
However, it was published in Italy and the United Kingdom and France and in Spain.
Okay, so you weren't holding on to it.
Mm-mm. Well, I may have been holding on to it in one way. I knew when I wrote it in 1986, that I would, if I was lucky, be able to write one about my father. It took me 30 more years.
Why?
Why did it take 30 years? Well, because my father died in 1960, and there were all those years between 1960 and now. It was also the case that my father, who was a traveling salesman, was gone from Monday to Friday in my growing up life. So even though he was a good father, and in most ways a quite present father when he was present, he was often away. And so I knew that I was going to have to take a long time or as much time as I needed to accumulate as much material as I could through memory, through talking to my cousins, through, you know, stumbling into this and that detail of life. That's generally the way I write novels. I just take as much time as I want to prepare. And then when I start out, I know that I've got a critical mass of material to choose from. So in the case of writing about my father, it just took a long time. I had to come up with a conceit, too, Jennifer. I had to think that somehow his absence, which was I don't want to say glaring, but it was never out of my sight. His absence was somehow going to have to be perceived as a presence. And so I was able ultimately to find a vocabulary and a conceit for that.
You know, so there's so many things that are interesting to me about your memoir of your parents. And one is that in one level, they led very unremarkable lives. But on another level, like so many people, even the least remarkable of us have really incredible stories to tell. I mean, your mother's mother had her when she was 14 years old.
Yes. But that was also in 1910, way up in the sticks in northwest Arkansas. So it may not have been at that time quite as remarkable as it would be today.
She got out.
She got out by hook and by crook. I mean, she got out because she was sent away to Catholic school in Fort Smith. And then she got out because she fortunately bumped into my father someplace, and immediately the two of them fell in love with each other. And that was the real exit port there, that when she married my father, they just saw, yes, this is for us. And thereafter, they put tough life behind them. But, you know, I'll say another thing, too. Ordinary people, if you call my parents ordinary, or anybody whom you might call ordinary, don't have to have remarkable stories about them to be of interest to us. It is through the notice of somebody such as I that we find a virtue in their ordinariness which doesn't overstate their ordinariness. I mean, it's in that way, it's like a Chekhov story. What is not noticeable, when it becomes noticeable, merits our notice.
One of the things that I love about your writing is it's very straightforward and factual, and then wham, there's an insight that almost comes out of nowhere. And
comes out of my fervent little brain.
Okay, comes out of Richard Ford's fervent. But that you're almost lulling us into something else, into straightforward storytelling, and then bam. Oh, by the way, here's what I'm thinking right now.
Well, I'm trying to interest you in life is what I'm trying to do, and to portray life in a way that makes it recognizable to you. And at the same time, I'm trying to think, what can I say about recognizable life that wouldn't be apparent or even imaginable to you, but that you read what I write? And so that's my use. I mean, my understanding of what literature is comes from F.R. Leavis, who said literature is the supreme means by which we renew our sensuous and emotional life and learn a new awareness. I'm always trying to provide that new awareness if I can.
Do you come onto that awareness through writing? Have you thought about what you're going to write before you sit down at the keyboard or the typewriter, or does the act of writing bring these out?
Both. I try to spend as much time as I can before I start to write, accumulating material, as I said, or thinking about the material that I'm going to use in an essay or a novel or a story. But, you know, the real creative writing, so to speak, in any piece of literature comes in the ligatures, comes in the ways in which what you have is connected to something else that you have in a way that couldn't have been anticipated. You know, there's a line which says composition is the arrangement of unequal things. Well, I'm always trying to arrange unequal things in a way and connect them. And it's the connective tissues that turn out to be the imaginative part.
You mentioned to me before we came on the air that you're writing now more than you ever have.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's good, though.
How often do you write?
Well, as often as I want to. I mean, I don't want to turn a free life into a life like a lawyer's. So I just work at the things that people offer me that interest me, like the Springsteen piece. I was the right person in the world to write about Springsteen because I'd been listening to him and writing about New Jersey for the past 45 years. And so it was a good thing to write. And then I wrote a piece for The Guardian about gun control and gun ownership in the United States last year. And I'm a hunter, and I'm not an NRA member. But I had something to say about that. And so, you know, people offer me things because I meet my deadlines and I try really hard and do the best I possibly can. And And so I just try to do the things that seem interesting to me and for which I'll have something new to say.
Has writing become easier for you or harder for you?
It was never hard. Anybody who tells you that writing is hard, you should grab your wallet around such a person. I mean, if it were that hard, I wouldn't be doing it, to be honest, particularly not at age 73. But I think that if you're a writer and you choose to write, you have no reason and shouldn't, in fact, complain about it. Anything you get to choose, which is of use to mankind, such as writing is, you shouldn't be complaining about it. So sometimes it's a little harder than it is other times, but for the most part, I always choose it.
I want to get back to the memoir. You were present when your father died. You were 16 years old.
Yes, that's right.
Is that... In the book, you define your relationship with your mother, and obviously so, before your father died and after your father died. Still today, at age 73, do you define your life by that moment?
No, I don't. I certainly define to some extent his life by that moment because it ended prematurely. He was only 55 years old. I think one of the reasons that made me write these two memoirs is that when I looked back on my wonderful parents and my childhood, my view was somewhat occluded by thoughts of their and the experience of their deaths. And I thought to myself, well, there has to be more in my mind than that. When I was teaching this course at Columbia this semester about memoir, it sort of started with a line of Walter Benjamin's from his essay called The Storyteller, in which he said, "The storyteller draws his authority from death." And what I figured out what it meant was that if you contemplate death, not in a morbid sense, but just to contemplate it, it will always take you back to life. That the importance of death is principally for me the fact that it has caused this life to stop, and this life is the more important thing. So what I wanted to do in writing my memoir, it had to include their deaths because they both died, was to concentrate more on their lived lives.
I'm wondering if you'll read one more passage for us. This is from the memoir, Between Them, page 64. And this is kind of what I was talking about before when there's a reflection that comes out of sort of just a straightforward sentence. The sentence was, "Later, when I was in junior high, he would regularly drive me to school on his way out of town on Mondays, but was never there on other days."
Right.
Pick it up from there.
As I record these events, I realize that, like many renditions of childhood, mine, under time's ruthlessness, might seem incomplete or lacking. I do not believe, however, that I was ever ignored or given a short straw, or that my father was anything but a good father, as good as he could be. I could not have said it at the time, but an unspoken part of my awareness must have been that I was the only son of a man who was trying to conduct life against odds. I can only intuit what was his effect on me, but if I had to, I would say that because I was his son, I can recognize now that life is short and has inadequacies, and that once again, it requires crucial avoidances as well as fillings in to be acceptable. Most everything but love goes away.
We're speaking with author Richard Ford. We'd love it if you have a question or comment for him. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post the Maine Calling Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. And WEX, providing global payment solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. Career opportunities at WEXINC.com.
On the next Fresh Air...
I got a place. Turns out a place that needs some robbing. A little robbing, not wholesale burglary, just looking for a certain item.
The FX series Fargo is back for a third season with more murder and mishap. We talk with series creator and writer Noah Hawley. He also created the FX series Legion and has a best-selling novel. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. For those of you who listen to Maine Public Classical, our Millbridge Mount Desert Island station, 93.7 FM, has been operating under low power since being hit by lightning last week. We are hopeful it will be back to full power sometime this week, perhaps midweek. Again, this affects just 93.7 FM of the Maine Public Classical Network, serving Down East, Mount Desert Island, and the Blue Hill area. Some of you may be able to hear 106.1 FM out of Bangor, or you can stream Maine Public Classical at mainepublic.org. Thanks for your patience.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Ford, who has written a new memoir about his parents. It's called Between Them. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. One of the small moments in your memoir is about your mother and you being in a public place and her pointing out to you the woman she believes was Eudora Welty.
Right.
And this is interesting to me because you just told me that your parents didn't read to you, you know, that this was books were not a big part of your life, but your mom really wanted you to see that. See her, and you're not even sure if it was her at the time.
Well, I was eight. I'm not really sure about anything that happened when I was eight, or maybe even younger. But we used to go over to the grocery store in Jackson, where we lived, because my mother hated to cook and was a terrible cook, and she just would have done anything not to have to cook lunch. And so in the summer, we used to walk over and stand in front of a steam table with our little tickets in our hand and wait till our number was called and then get a plate full of food and take it either home with us or eat it there. And once my mother said to me, Richard, do you see that woman standing over there? And I looked, and she said, that's Eudora Welty. She's a writer. And and when I wrote that, I had to concede the fact that my mother might have been wrong. But in her view, she was right, that was Eudora. And many years later, because I knew Eudora quite well, I would see Eudora in that very same place. It's a place called the Jitney 14 in Jackson. It's a very famous place in Jackson, Mississippi. And I saw Eudora there lots of times. And so when I remember back to that moment when my mother said that that was Eudora with great reverence in her voice, I think, well, it could have been true. And she could have been right.
How did you come to know her later in your life?
Well, I sent her the first two books that I wrote. One would, for being from Jackson. I grew up in her neighborhood. And she didn't write back to me or say anything to me. She didn't know me, and I didn't know her. Our families were not on the same plane, so to speak. And later, when I published The Sports Writer, I did a little book signing at Lemuria Bookstore in Jackson, and a line of people was standing there waiting to have books signed. And I looked up, and there was Miss Welty. And she had a very deep, wonderful, charitable but also mirthful voice. She said, I just had to come pay my respects. He said, so that's where we first met in what was for me the most ideal of circumstances. And then she sat down and at my table, because she was at the end of the line, and we talked and talked and talked and talked and got to be quite good friends through the rest of her life. Indeed, for a while, I was her literary executor.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Oh, it's a funny story. And it's a long, typical Mississippi story. It would take forever. You'd have to have another program to tell the story. But she... When she finally made me her literary executor, she asked me, she said, or rather I asked her, I said, Eudora, I said, what is the one thing you can tell me that you do not want to happen? Because she was getting quite old at the time. She said, well, she said, I don't want there to be an authorized biography of me. And I thought, well, okay, that seems reasonable. There won't be one under my watch then. And in about 4 weeks, somebody called me and said, Eudora has authorized a biography of herself. So I thought, well, why am I your literary executor if you're going to just end run me on this thing?
What was her response? Did you ask her?
No, I didn't ask her. She was getting what she wanted, and she got from Suzanne Mars, who was a friend of hers and the writer of her biography, a quite wonderful biography. So it didn't matter, but it was just one of those typical kind of Mississippi absurdities.
Why do you live in Maine now? Why not Mississippi?
Well, I go to Mississippi all the time. I probably talk to my high school friends every week in Mississippi. We're very close. And Christina and I have a house in New Orleans as well. But I, you know, when I left Mississippi in 1962, I was really keen on seeing the rest of the country. If you live in Mississippi and are born in Mississippi, you either think you live in the center of a wonderful universe or you think you live in the center of someplace you got to get out of. And I was of the second group. So I went away to school at Michigan State and lived all over the country. And at a certain point in 1999, I was trying to persuade my wife, Christina, to leave her job in New Orleans and come live with me. So I went where I thought I could find the most beautiful house in America, and did, in essence. And I thought that if I bought a house on the ocean and could lure her up there, life would be great. It took me 5 more years to lure her up there, but ultimately she came.
So the plan succeeded.
The plan succeeded, and the plan is still succeeded into marriage year 50.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here in Maine with us.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Adam, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Adam. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Actually, you just jumped my question about why Maine. But I'll switch gears to another question, which is, did Katrina have any effect on you in terms of your writing or your outlook? I'm a transplant from New Orleans as well. Moved here about, born in New Orleans and lived there all my life until about 4 years ago. Live in Owl's Head now, and am loving it as well. And anyway, I just didn't know if Katrina might have had some effect on you.
Well, Katrina had a big effect on Christina and me because Christina was fired from her job as the head of city planning by Mayor Nagin the year before Katrina. Mayor Nagin is now in a federal penitentiary where his sorry self belongs. But then we moved back to Maine at that point. I had the house there. We had been kind of going back and forth. But after Katrina, we then moved back down to New Orleans and took part in the rebuild. And ultimately, and these are just vocational consequences, ultimately Christina went back to New Orleans and was the chief of staff for the mayor. But as far as my own working life is concerned, I wrote a story, a sort of Katrina story, which was published in The New Yorker called Leaving for Kenosha, about an African-American family that moves to Kenosha, Wisconsin. But my sense of life's transience was certainly deepened, I suppose, by Katrina. My sense of the city of New Orleans and its prosperity and its post-storm prosperity was certainly punctuated because a lot of human beings were scoured out of New Orleans who never came back. So, but profoundly affected in my view of the world, probably not.
Adam, good question.
Thank you.
An email from Carl. Canada is a very different novel from the Frank Bascom books. I was wondering if you could speak about the inspiration for Canada.
Well, the inspiration for Canada came about in about 1988 or 89 when I was waiting around for some bound galleys of a little book I wrote called Wildlife to come along back from the publisher. And I was just sitting around in a little house in Dutton, Montana with Christina. And to idle away some time, I started writing a story that I called Canada, and it was about an adolescent boy who, for reasons I didn't know, but against his will, was caused to leave Montana and go to Saskatchewan. And then the bound galleys came back, and I stopped working on that story. But I thought, gee, there's something to this story. I don't know why the little boy is made to go across the border. I don't know who the little boy is. I don't know who his parents were. But again, just as was the case with the memoir about my father, I took 25 years to figure out what would fill in that book and ultimately did get enough material to write it. Its difference from the Frank Bascom books is not exceptional to me because we all of us talk with different voices depending on what we're talking about, depending on whom we're addressing, depending on how old we are, depending on what we're trying rhetorically to achieve. So when writers are said to speak with one voice, it's never really true. This is a kind of a chestnut in writing workshops in which you say, or which someone says, not me, you really just have to find your voice. Well, finding your voice is to find about 15 voices, which are all apposite to the material that you're going to use. So it isn't surprising to me that Canada sounds one way and Frank Bascom sounds another. I've got those voices just as do we all.
We're talking with author Richard Ford. You mentioned your high school friends you stay in touch with. If I were interviewing one of them right now, would they say Richard has always been a heck of a storyteller?
Gee. Yeah, but they might not mean it in a complimentary way, Jennifer. But, you know, Joan Didion says in that book that I mentioned, The Year of Magical Thinking, well, I guess it was actually in Slouching Towards Bethlehem, she said we should all keep in some relationship to the people that we used to be. And so that, in a way, helps me keep in a sort of nodding relationship with the person I used to be and to find the through lines from then to now. I would hate it if the man I am now was unidentifiable from the boy I was at 16. I mean, that's just my particular self-preoccupation, I suppose. But I wouldn't want to have become somebody whom my friends in high school couldn't recognize.
We'll go up to Thomaston and Jason. Hi, Jason. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Oh, good afternoon, and I love the spoken word. My memory of my youth was triggered when the author described his single childhood as luxurious. And that was my trigger for these memories because in my party of five siblings, we used to lament and we would speculate, oh, wow, only child. It sounds like such an impoverishment. They don't get to be like their, like, inner gang. And so I thought, oh, wow, that's really amazing. And as I said to the screener, you know, we recognized that there were, like, economic benefits to, like, small families. But at the same time, you know, the kind of interpersonal dynamic and all, we thought must be lacking in some way. And so we, you know, we felt so differently. And I love hearing it described as luxurious.
Well, Jason, I completely understand what you mean. It must be in some ways more socializing to have some brothers and sisters. I can't use the word siblings. I'm sorry. It offends my ears. But to have brothers and sisters, you must learn a whole bunch of things from them that your parents don't have to teach you. I mean, my parents, whom I do think of as having provided me a luxurious life, they left a lot of the socializing to school. And while they loved me, they weren't particularly good at explaining things to me or telling me things. The luxury of it was that I had their full attention when I had it. I never had to divide it. And they had my full attention, believe me, when they needed it. And that we could always say we loved each other.
Jason, thanks for your call. We'll move to Scarborough and Linda. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm calling to thank Richard Ford for his work.
Thank you, Linda.
I'm your age, Richard.
Well, we can commiserate, Linda.
Yeah, but I didn't come on to your work until a few years ago when I first read The Sports Writer. It was very important to me because I read it shortly after my son died.
Oh, I'm sorry that happened, and I'm sorry you had some solace to find somewhere.
I found a great deal of solace in your work, and I want to thank you for it. And since then, I've been reading everything you've written that I could lay my hands on.
Thank you so much. That's kind of you to say so.
And I wish you well.
Thank you, and I you.
A fan, one of many. We have Richard Ford on our program today. You are very honest about a sentence you wish that you had not said to your mother, and it's heartbreaking when you read it, and it, of course, makes the reader think of things one regrets with their own parents. Before I ask you to talk about the actual moment, did you pause and wonder if you wanted to let this out into the world?
No.
No.
No, it became almost inevitable to tell it if I was going to tell about the immediate period prior to my mother's death. It just seemed impossible to avoid.
And it's such a small and really could have been interpreted as an insignificant thing to say, but it wasn't.
Or it could have been ignored altogether. My mother, I was living in Bennington, Vermont, and my mother was ill with metastatic breast cancer, so ill that she had to have a transfusion, even to leave Little Rock and come up and spend some weeks with Christina and me. And when she had been up in Bennington for a couple, oh, I would say 10 or 12 days, it was starting to get cold, and she was beginning not to feel very good, and she was deciding to go home, back to Little Rock. And she sat me down one day, and she said to me, Richard, she said, I think I was 36 years old. She said, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to look after myself now in the coming times, because she knew she was quite ill. And I said, well, Mother, I said, if that's how you feel, I said, then you can move in with Christina and me. And she said, oh, she said, really? Because we talked about this many times in the past, and she hadn't ever wanted to do that because she'd taken care of her own mother, not happily. And she thought that it was a bad idea for kids to take care of their parents into their late years. And so I said, well, you can move in with us. And she said, well, then, okay, she said, then I'll start to make my plans toward that. And I said at that moment, I said, well, I said, don't make those plans quite yet. And she looked at me, and I could see some feeling of opportunity leave her eyes. And I never knew, I suppose, if I said that to her because I had some hope that she might live on, or if I thought, no, you're probably not going to be alive in 8 weeks, and why disrupt your life in that way? And I think she heard in my voice both of those sides of that emotional equation. And I wish I hadn't ever said that. I wish I had just said to my mother, yes, indeed, you move in with us and everything will be rosy, but that is not what I said.
And there's no way you could have known.
Well, that she would be dead in 8 weeks?
Well, that she would have taken what seems like a sign of optimism, words of optimism, in a different way.
Well, that was my imagination, Jennifer. That's what I do. I think back over things, particularly in the context of a piece of writing like this. I think back over things that I did, and I try to assess them. And you ask if I was hesitant about writing this. I wasn't hesitant about writing it, because the writing such as mine is public writing. That I write this so that someone will read it. And if I can use myself as a specimen for someone who can then enter one's relationship with one's dying or aged parent in a more acutely aware way, I should do that.
We're talking with Richard Ford. We have to take one more break. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
If you go to the grocery store and you just want some barbecue sauce, good luck choosing one.
Caribbean jerk, sesame ginger, Hawaiian, steak and chop.
The glory and curse of the limitless variety at the supermarket.
It's the best of America and the worst of America, right here in one bright neon-lit landscape.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening right here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have City Arts and Lectures. Today's guest is journalist Amy Walter. She's currently serving as a national editor of the Cook Political Report, and she's a frequent guest on the PBS NewsHour. That's journalist Amy Walter on City Arts and Lectures, coming up at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, best-selling novelist and short story writer Richard Ford. He's written a new memoir about the lives of his parents. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. The memoir is Between Them, Remembering My Parents. Why the title?
It's my one little act of genius in this book. Every book has to have one tiny act of genius somewhere or it doesn't blossom. I came, as children do, literally from between my parents, from some act that occurred. And when I was born, I literally, physically, bodily came between them. And yet, what was persistent in my parents' lives was that in spite of my presence there, what was most important to their lives was what was between them. I was always third among the three of us, in a way that I find to be so wholesome and in a way that caused me no neurosis or anything. As I said earlier, they were the parents. They were the adults in the room. I was the child. They loved me. My interests were subordinate to their interests. And it doesn't hurt for children to understand that when you are a child. They were looking after me. My interests were always secondary to theirs, but secondary in a way that meant not less.
It strikes me that when I read your memoir that there's a part of you that is almost perplexed by their love for you and the level of their love for you. Am I reading that right?
I'm exhilarated by it. That's certainly the case. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to write this was because I was exhilarated, in addition to the fact that I missed them a lot, even into my present age. But perplex. No, I mean, it's my model for families is that the parents love the children and the children love the parents. And so I wasn't in a perplexity about that. I was just happy.
I'm going to go to Rick, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I just said a quick question. Richard had mentioned the fact that his mother, I guess, was in Bennington, Vermont, and I was in Bennington for 15 years. So I didn't know if I might have run across his mother in some way. So I just was curious about that as to where she might have lived in Bennington.
Yeah, I think you misheard.
Rick, it was I who lived in Bennington. Actually, it was in Bennington County. It was in the little town of North Pownall, which I'm sure you know. I was teaching at Williams College at the time. And my mother just came up to Bennington from Little Rock to be with me during the time in her life when she could last be with me.
Okay. I lived up in Shaftesbury, and so maybe we ran across each other in some way. It was just so curious listening to you.
Maybe on the Batanquil River, Rick.
Yeah, maybe. That could be a way that we found. Maybe in one of the little taverns up in...
No, I don't do taverns. I just drink quietly at home.
Rick, thanks for calling. So what are you working on now?
Zero. Nothing. You know, there just has to be these times, Jennifer, when you don't do anything. I think it's useful to
me. Okay, what's percolating now?
Well, I have a long Frank Bascom novel, which I could write if I had the chops for it, which I've accumulated for the last two years. And then I have a little novel set in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, which I also don't have the chops for. But maybe in the fullness of time, get on to the end of the summer and get through pheasant season and get into next winter, I'll get around to it. I'm just not one of these people who hurries things. If I have to hurry at anything, I'm not any good at it.
So when you say you don't have the chops for it, define chops. Because usually that means the skill.
Well, for me, it means the skill. Each novel that you write requires a whole new set of skills. One novel doesn't teach the next novel very much, which is good in a way because it assures newness. It also means just the physical energy for it. I just finished a term of teaching, and I'm in the midst of publicizing this book, and I'd like to have a little time off so I could sort of recoup energies. And then comes the fall, and I go to Europe to publicize this book, and then comes pheasant season, and nothing gets in the way of pheasant and grouse season for me. First things first.
Okay. Priorities. When you write a novel, do you have it mapped out? Do you have an outline stuck on the wall, or do you not know how it's going to end?
You mean like William Faulkner did with Absalom? No, I don't have an outline per se, as if you were to outline a sentence. What I have is what I call my general factual outline, which is a big fat notebook full of just exactly that, notes, with little dividers for each of the formal constituents of the book, a divider for Frank Bascom, a divider for his wife, a divider for New Jersey, a divider for everything that I think the book's going to contain. And I then fill that over the course of years with all of the material I think the book will ultimately draw upon. And then what I do is I just study this big old fat notebook. It's just the kind of notebook that a child would take to school, except mine's fatter, and as if I were studying for an exam. And over the course of poring over this material for months, I began to sort of winkle out where a first sentence might be and where the story might go and what might happen in the middle. And as I said before, I can figure out where the high points are in the book or the arc of the book, but where the real best writing comes in is in the connective tissues when I string together one high point toward another high point.
And is this notebook all handwritten? And can you read your own handwriting?
It is handwritten. Here's my little notebook. No one can see this but you and me. Here's my little notebook. But
it's tiny.
But I have hundreds of these. And I actually write in them by hand. And then I transcribe them out onto, you know, paper and print them up. And, you know, in different categories in my notebook, one would be Frank, one would be his wife, one would be New Jersey. Many times the same material turns up in each category because I don't know when I put it in there how I'm going to use it or if indeed I ever will use it. So I just lard the good things through so that they recur. It's, you know, clerically, it's a kind of a hell. But on the other hand, it's the only kind of hell, you know, it's my hell.
Well, speaking of the kind of hell, I was wondering if I walked into your studio or your home, are there bookshelves full of little tiny notebooks?
I usually keep my notebooks in the refrigerator. We have a second refrigerator down in the utility room.
Are you pulling my leg?
No, I can't even reach your leg from here. No.
You keep them in the refrigerator?
I do. I keep them in the refrigerator because it's an old archy habit. My parents being from rural Arkansas, they put important documents in the refrigerator because if the house burned down,
that's right.
Maybe the refrigerator wouldn't burn or would be the last thing to burn. So just out of instinct or learned habit, I stick things in there. So if you opened my refrigerator, you'd see some dead pheasants and a bottle of vodka and a bunch of notebooks.
And how many notebooks?
Well, for the book that I'm working on or would be working on if I were working on it, probably 35 of these little notebooks.
You mentioned you write literature now. Have you ever taught writing?
I have when I was younger. I think maybe in some ways it's a young man or a young person's vocation, but not for me anymore. I just don't have the patience. And you know, the world that I wrote into when I was 24, 25 years old is a very different publishing and reading world from the one that is in existence today. So it's sort of like not having children today as opposed to having children 60, 70 years ago. You're admitting them to a future that is a different future from the one that I was admitted to. And so I don't feel as secure, nor would I be as secure as a teacher of writing as I might have been 25 or so years ago. I mean, I still believe in the sanctity of literature and the sanctity of letters and the imagination, but it's a business different from the business that I encountered when I was younger.
Our friend Josh Bodwell posted on Facebook.
Good man.
Richard described his 1990 novel Wildlife as a, quote, little novel, but he was being too modest. It's anything but. Wildlife is a breathtaking, fictive exploration of youth and our relationships with our parents, all in less than 200 pages.
Well, that's nice of him to say so. It was always the book of mine that I probably felt most protective of because it wasn't very warmly received when it was published in 1990. And it was the reception of that book that caused me back then never to read another book review after having my fragile little heart rent by what people said about it. But Paul Dano has now made a movie out of it, and it's been in print ever since. So I don't feel vindicated. I don't need to be vindicated. But I feel satisfied that it has passed, you know, its period of review and gone into people's lives in the way that you want books to.
Who are you excited about reading today?
I read a lot. There's a woman down in Boston who is a quite wonderful novelist who's not getting her due named Jennifer Hay, H-A-I-G-H. She wrote a terrific book called Heat and Light about a year and a half ago. If I had to choose one book that I read in that period of time, it would be that book. It's a book, a luminous book, really.
A luminous book.
Yeah.
And you said, and I'm guessing from reading your memoir, from talking with you, that to say you're a voracious reader may be an understatement.
Well, I'm voracious in one way. Because I'm dyslexic, I'm a very slow reader. And so my appetite is great, but the number of books that I consume is commensurately fewer because I don't read very fast. But I have a pretty good retention because I read slowly, being dyslexic. So, yeah, I read a lot of books. People send me books to read and to endorse if I can endorse them. So I'm never wanting for books to read. The only problem is sometimes that I don't often, because people are sending me books, read as much of the books that I myself would choose, or I haven't reached back into the past to pick up the book that I should have read when I was in college, but for some reason or other didn't, because I'm so preoccupied with my own work and preoccupied with trying to help my colleagues get along in the world.
Do you have a favorite of your own books? Is it Wildfire?
No, it's not. It's not. Because I tried as hard as I possibly could for each of those books, 12 of them, not very many actually, and nobody ever hurried me. Nobody ever told me I had to do something in those books that I didn't want to do. I therefore don't have to choose one against the other because I did them all as well as I humanly could.
Richard Ford, it's such a pleasure to have you on Maine Calling, and I hope you'll come back.
Well, if you ask me, I'll come, and it's nice to talk to you.
Oh, excellent. Richard Ford's new book is a memoir about his parents, and it's called Between Them, Remembering My Parents. There's also a wonderful Fresh Air interview with Terry Gross and Richard Ford that I'm sure you can find online. We'll put on our Facebook book page. And also, Richard will be at Space Gallery in Portland on June 22nd for an event sponsored by the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. At our website for more information. Also, a programming note for those of you in the Bangor area, Maine Calling will be broadcasting this Thursday, May 18th, live from the Bangor Public Library. We will be discussing the role of libraries in an age of Google and smartphones. Again, we'll be live at the Bangor Public Library. The public is invited this Thursday at 1. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Sam Dearen answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with a panel of experts about the ever-changing national political landscape. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.